Generation is really trying to have the rhetoric mean something, not to throw out the rhetoric, but to say, okay, guys, we're being tested. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Not what are we going to say, but what are we going to do? Are we going to divest? Are we going to not let weapons companies recruit on our campus? Like, what are we going to do materially that we can do? And we have to do it.
You're listening to Naomi Klein. What are we going to do? This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program and for her doppelganger book, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
I wanted to ask you about how the figure of the double ganger helps you get to all of these conclusions and also issue these warnings about what's going on. I'm just curious about how your story about Wolf is not a specific story. It's not a personal story. It's actually a story about how it is also a universal story. It's about how societies and countries have become double gangers of themselves. Right, whether it's Israel, whether it's the United States, whether it's, you know, or any other society. Yeah. And you say on page 274, what if the full-blown fascism is not the monster at the door, but the monster inside the house, the monster inside of us? Right? This is the biggest danger, right? Sort of, we follow you in the story about Wolf, but we shouldn't really just stay there, obviously.
What I realized was that having a doppelganger was a sort of, my friend Keel McClear, who's a wonderful writer, talked about it as a narrow aperture that could let me look at a few different things. I'd wanted to return to the subject of personal branding, for instance, because a brand is kind of a double that we make of ourselves, right? My first book was about branding, but it came out, you know, in 2000, and it was pre-iPhone, it was pre-social media. It was not yet possible for all of us to be brands. I mean, when I wrote No Logo, Michael Jordan was a brand, but, you know, English professors were not brands, you know? But suddenly we all ended up with advertising companies in our back pockets, and they told us it was free. They didn't tell us they were going to hoover up all the data and make doppelgangers of us using AI, but that's a whole other story, right? So what I realized is, oh, this is interesting. I have a branding problem. There's another Naomi who people think is me, and she's doing all kinds of wild things, and people keep screaming at me on the internet about it. But then I'm like, well, is that me on the internet, or is that a doppelganger of me, and who are any of us? And this was like, you know, deep pandemic thinking. And so I realized I could get back at this subject, but not do it from the outside, kind of do it from the inside, right, where we're all implicated, right? It's easy to be like, oh, you are the brand, and I am a true human. But we're all of none of our choosing, all trying to kind of get by. And I think the impulse to perfect the self is really an impulse really to survive when so much security has been stripped away in this economic model. We're trying to build our little branded lifeboats, right? So part of how I mapped this was by reading a lot of books about doppelgangers and watching a lot of films about doppelgangers and calling it research. So, you know, I read Dostoevsky, the Double, and Saramago, and watch Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, and a lot of Jordan Peele. And, you know, what you realize is that many artists have used the figure of the doppelganger to explore fascism, to explore this feeling of, like, you know, Freud talked about how we're drawn to the doppelganger because the doppelganger stands in for the lives we might have lived, right? Like, we know that even though we live in a system that tells us that we are all, you know, authors of our own destiny and responsible for all of our successes, you know, that our lives could be so different. The person we are is not the result just of our own actions. It's the result of these accidents of birth and decisions that our parents and grandparents made and the systems we were born into and the privileges and the lack thereof that bestowed on us. So this idea that there's another you walking around that other people think are you stands in for this feeling of, like, is there, like, could I be someone else, right? And also, like, could I be someone worse? Am I not the person who I think I am? And so the reason why I say it can't just be about her, is that one of the things I learned from reading a lot of doppelganger literature is that often the stories follow a certain arc where, like, somebody realizes there's another them walking around and they just go off on a self-righteous journey to confront their doppelganger and perhaps kill them. And this invariably leads to the protagonist being dead on the ground because the doppelganger is always them. Like, the doppelganger is you. It's holding up a mirror going, do you like what you see? You can't stab your doppelganger, even if you would like to. You have to actually see what your doppelganger is showing you, parts of yourself that you don't want to see. There's so much talk of fascism in the moment that we're in. Is he or isn't he? That this should be a moment where we really look at ways in not just that they are acting like fascists, but that we might be.
You know, you mentioned Walter Benjamin's famous line of every document of civilization is necessarily and always a document of barbarism. And also, Aimé Césaire, who said very eloquently, he said that colonialism, modernity, and fascism are all just a snaking old story, right? It's like these are things that are happening. We are not better than other people. We're not better than other cultures. We think that we are, and we want to teach them all kinds of lessons, but we should also check in the fascism at the door.
I think this was the part of the research that was most important for me personally, and that has been most orienting in terms of understanding the moment. The book came out a month before October 7th, and that has helped me sort of understand the rise of the far right globally, helped me to understand the ways in which people I know and grew up with are rationalizing atrocities right now. And that is, you quoted Cesar and Benjamin. I went to a Jewish day school. I thought I understood what the Holocaust was and what fascism was. It turns out I was not exposed to a huge body of literature that And neither was almost anyone I know, which is embarrassing, including my parents who are lefties, But all of these anti-colonial thinkers in the 30s and 40s were saying about the rise of fascism in Europe that this is not new. This is not a rupture. This is imperialism, colonialism, boomeranging, in Césaire's words, back to Europe. Now, I know there are many scholars in this room who are familiar with this literature. I was not. The literature I grew up with was the Holocaust was a rupture in time and space. Once again, a shock without history. In fact, to compare it with any other genocide was anti-Semitic. There was, in the words of Claude Lanzmann, a ring of fire around the Holocaust. And so even like to do any, like he was talking about filmmaking, but you can't go into it, you can't understand it, like that there was a forbidding. In fact, Lanzmann used this sentence to describe, Claude Lanzmann made this landmark documentary series called Shoah, which was how a lot of people learned about the Holocaust. It was 9.5 hours, and Lanzmann was a contemporary of Sartre, a colleague, and Beauvoir. He was in the French Resistance. He made this landmark film. But this was a really, really key part of how he explained the Holocaust to the world. He used this phrase, here there is no why. Here there is no why about Auschwitz and about the Holocaust. The phrase comes from Primo Levi, who was in Auschwitz, and he was quoting a guard saying, here there is no why. So if anyone is asking why they're there, and the answer was, here there is no why. So a guard's answer to a prisoner becomes why we're not allowed to say why, how, can we compare, how did it happen? So W.E.B. Du Bois, Cesar, Benjamin, later Arendt, many others, we're trying to understand the lineages of European fascism. And the lineages are in settler colonialism here. Hitler was very open about what he learned from the Jim Crow South, from eugenics here. The whole idea of Lebensraum expanding, getting elbow room to the east, was built on the Western frontier. I mean, it was an expansion of that, but also the genocide, the German genocide of the Nama and Herero in what is now Namibia, after the First World War, Germany lost its colonies, including in Africa, and so decided to expand eastward, right? So there are all of these, like, not wavy lines, but straight lines from colonialism in the global south and settler colonialism here and in Australia and Canada. And it was not part of our Holocaust education, which means we don't know. I mean, we watch all these interviews. Is he a fascist? People do not know what fascism is. They're acting as if it has to be a replica of Hitler and Mussolini, as opposed to something that is deeply encoded in our histories, right? That has always been here. Even this idea, could it happen here? It never happened here. It happened here. It happened here. It happened. And so if we don't understand that fascism, it has always been our twin, right? And this is what Jordan Peele is trying to show us with all the doubles. Then how will we recognize it? Doppelgangers help.
Very much so. I want to get to Palestine and Israel. October 7 was a terrible day, no matter which way you look at things. But when I see the reaction to October 7, or what preceded October 7, the dehumanization, the decontextualization, the banalization of suffering, the use of divine prophecy to call some children children of light and others children of darkness, unleashing the worst military power on civilians, this license to kill, maim, erase, evict, and disregard international law, the suppression of speech, the denial of Palestinian tears and grief, and the callous indifference and direct support of our government. How do we ever reach a resolution when this level of toxic doubling of the ethnic other is happening?
Well, thank you for that. How do we do it? I mean, I think partly, you know, what I was saying before about how we respond to this moment, how we meet this moment. First, we do have to look, and I know a lot of people have, you know, it becomes too much and you look away. And if you are one of those people who stopped looking, I would really implore you to look. I mean, I don't think we need to be marinating in the images all the time, but I think we can go to trusted sources, good journalism. I think The Guardian's been doing some very good reporting. I think Al Jazeera's been doing some very good reporting. And understand that we are in a new phase right now where those early statements of intent that form part of South Africa's genocide case before the ICJ, quoting all of these Israeli officials saying what they plan to do in Gaza, is now happening in northern Gaza right now. And more than 1 million people are at risk of starvation. All of the hospitals are under attack, are not functioning. And so I hope people do look and think about what we're called to do. There is no justification for genocide. It's why we have a genocide convention. We can't hide behind, well, they did that and they want to do this. It doesn't matter. There is no justification for genocide. This is how a culture is erased. It is very, very deliberate, and it's happening before our eyes. So this is why what we do now really matters. Also matters how we treat each other. You know, I think that there are some things we can control and there's some things we can't control. You know, there are things that we can demand of our government in terms of a weapons embargo. I mean, this has to be the number one demand, is to stop arming the state. It's your taxpayers, it's your weapons, your tax dollars and your weapons. All of ours, really. I'm an American as well. But then I also think that we have to model another way to be with one another, you know, in our movements, in our social movements. You know, and as a Jewish person who, I'm part of an anti-war movement, I'm part of a, you know, movement against apartheid, occupation. I've been on the board of Jewish Voice for Peace for 15 years. And the way I see the work with Jewish Voice for Peace is partly a response to, you know, what I see as, you know, sometimes called Judeo-pessimism, similar to Afro-pessimism, right? This idea that Jew hatred is eternal, primordial, and so powerful that you can't respond to it with any of the usual tools. We're never going to be free of these hatreds, but there are things that we can do in terms of actually respecting universal human rights and commitments to equality before the law and real solidarity in ways that we can show up for one another that can mitigate them in very serious ways, right? And I really do believe in that multiracial, multiethnic alliance. And that's a big part of the Jewish tradition, particularly before the Holocaust. And after the Holocaust, many of the people who were part of fighting for those multi-ethnic futures were annihilated. But, you know, they were annihilated in the Holocaust. They were annihilated in Stalin's camps. And so it sort of seemed like Zionism was the only possible response left, an ethnostate. So I don't believe in that ethnostate, and I believe it was always leading to this moment. But when I say that, that also means that I need to be fighting for Jews to be safe here, right? Because a big part of Zionism's argument is that you need an ethnostate because Jews will never be safe. There will always be another Holocaust around the corner, right? And so I think really fighting for one another and really committing ourselves to one another's, you know, our mutual liberation and safety is part of fighting that here, right? So I think, what can we control? We can fight to stop sending the weapons, we can divest, and we can model what it means to fight hatred, all forms of hatred, anti-Palestinian hatred, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Black racism, all of it, right, in coalition with one another, and build real cultures of care. And that's really hard work. It's really hard work during a genocide. And I think it might be even more important in those moments when it's hard.
So Q&A, who has a question?
Great, hi, thank you. I have a question about related and different, relating to sort of the shock doctrine in light of a lot of the news coming out of what happened post-Helene with the disinformation and Russian hackers. And I'm curious just your thoughts in general about this sort of new political disinformation doppelganger, how the two relate for you, but also putting it into the lens of the way you were just speaking about Gaza, of what can we do and what should we do? Because I think what can we do is looking at the Russian framework and outside actors, but I'm curious into your thoughts of sort of the relational, what should we do? Thank you.
I think there are a lot of different players, and the fact that Elon Musk is, fired all the content moderators and wants to amplify, is personally amplifying this, is, you know, that's a domestic problem, you know, that he was allowed to buy Twitter in the first place, and that this is so deregulated, you know, to the degree that, you know, when he bought Twitter, he said it, he wanted it because it was the global town square, right? So I think we need to start thinking about what it means to have an information commons. You know, this really is a public good, and it needs to be treated and regulated as such. And it's simply, you know, wild that one person could just buy it and turn it into their plaything and amplify disinformation. You know, he amplified the, you know, the FEMA spending money on migrants lie. But also, I mean, what we need to do is not give in to this sort of like, oh, they're the crazy people. We know everything is fine, you know, because everything is not fine. We need to talk about climate change, and we need to talk about what we're going to do in the face of climate change. And we need to talk about the conspiracies that are peer reviewed and that we can prove and that we know about, including the fact that Trump brought, you know, I think it was 10 oil executives to Mar-a-Lago and promised them if they gave him $1 billion, he would roll back Biden's entire environmental agenda. You know, that's kind of conspiratorial, you know, it's just normalized conspiracy. So we need to kind of denormalize that because it should not be allowed. So I think this brings us to like what, you know, what are the priorities? Money in politics. I think having an actual like healthy information ecology, investing in reliable media is important, you know, various kinds. So
we live in a democracy. We believe in the idea that we can vote and we can elect people into power. We want to talk about, like, you know, functional media, et cetera. But we don't live in any of that right now. And we're watching infrastructures that were backstops come undone. And so one of the things I'm curious about is, as you're thinking about this, how do we get past, like, it would be great if we had functioning media. It would be great if we had functioning Congress. And where are, in your mind, some of the more tactical things that can be done, as we're not just seeing the challenges that are the big screen TV challenges, but the genuine infrastructural erosion challenges.
I think different things are possible depending on different electoral outcomes. I'm not sure I know exactly how to fix America right now. I know that it says that I'm going to get you back to stable ground. But, I mean, we are pretty far gone. Like, we're pretty deep in the rubble. You know, this is why, you know, that Walter Benjamin quote, I mean, it really is, it's about the angel of history, and it's about the fact that it's cumulative, right? I mean, our defeats add up, and we don't get to the blank sheet where we're just like, make everything perfect. We need to build power, and I don't think there are any shortcuts to that. In really building institutional power, whether it's trade unions or organizations that are membership-based that we can rely on in these moments, be suspicious when you see things online that seem to all be about tearing down the few institutions that we have left. Ask who would benefit if we had nothing we could rely on. You know, I was very active in the Bernie campaign, but I recognized that we were kind of skipping some phases of just kind of going straight for the presidency before we had really done that kind of ground up building. So I think that there are some exciting things that are happening with union organizing across the country, and we need to use our collective voices as much as we can.
I am a student here at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I'm also like a pretty engaged in the student and community activism movements here, first in the climate movement and right now in the Palestine movement, and I'm actually like currently working with a couple of the students that were suspended recently too. And so as a veteran activist and organizer in a lot of these spaces, and who's written a lot about like of these groups that have faced oncoming repression, what kind of advice do you think you could give to students that are active in organizing here to create and promote that kind of progressive change?
That's a great question, and thanks for your organizing. I think there's strength in numbers. Having alliances that are intergenerational is also important. Some of the sturdiest activism that we've seen in this period are in places where students and undergrads and graduate students and faculty members have organized together and, you know, won some significant victories, even if not enough. I mean, I was recently at Cornell where a graduate student, Mamadou Tal, I don't know if he was completely suspended, but to the extent that he was going to be deported. And there was a huge petition. I think 10,000 people signed it. And they had to re-enroll him so that he wasn't going to be deported. So now he can stay and finish his PhD. So, I mean, it does show that despite the fact that these universities are very, very fearful, in particular, you know, they're afraid of donors, they're afraid of Congress, you know, people can organize and they can also be a force on campus that administrators have to respond to, right? This is just organized power that they are afraid of, and we need to be organized as well. That often does mean that not everybody is going to agree, right? And, you know, one of the ways that I look in the mirror and I'm concerned about what I see on our side is I really feel like we've lost the knack of debate within our ranks. Like, there's often a just kind of like, you know, this is like a maximalist position and everyone has to take that on, or they're not even worth engaging in. Then you end up with a small movement. I'm sorry, you know. I think we need to create on-ramps where people can get involved without already agreeing on everything, you know? This is something we do on the left. We didn't know it last week, but now we know it, and no one's allowed in who doesn't already know it. You know, this is like one of the things that I really love about like the film Israelism. I like it because it shows people changing their mind. It shows people who used to believe one thing and now they learned other things. Now they believe something else. It's not the only film we should be seeing. We should be seeing lots of films from a Palestinian perspective, but being able to see people change their minds in public. People change at university. It's one of the great things about universities. We get exposed to new worldviews and we change our worldview. But how do we do that, right? How do we do that in a way that is loving? And, you know, not everybody needs to play that role educating a newbie. For some people, that's going to be a lot more painful than others. But, you know, we need to organize so that there are people who do that work, right? So, yeah, like, what are the on-ramps? You know, what are the first steps? How do we create welcoming cultures that replenish us? Because it's hard, you know, it's hard people are taking real risks. We need to actually even have fun. I know it sounds crazy, but I actually believe that as organizers, we need to create opportunities where we like cook together, have a nice time together, heal each other, like feel what we're actually feeling, create like soft spaces where you can actually talk and not yell into the void, you know, of social media. All those things help, like where it's like, well, imagine like building a movement where like it would be like somewhere that we would want to spend time. And I've seen some of that, but I've also seen the opposite, like really kind of punishing activist cultures. And I also get that because people are in so much goddamn pain, which is really understandable. And it often happens that when you're in pain, you just look to like have an effect on the people who you can hurt, which is not your university administrator, but is like probably somebody you're friends with. These are like my little pearls of wisdom from, you know, 30 years of activism. Be a little bit nicer to each other if you can. Thank you so much.
You were just listening to Naomi Klein, What Are We Going to Do? She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder at the end of October. Naomi Klein is a professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Her writing has appeared in leading publications around the world. She's a columnist for The Guardian. She's the award-winning author of such bestsellers as This Changes Everything, No Logo, On Fire, and her latest book, Doppelganger. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. And we have a series of Naomi Klein programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Naomi Klein, What Are We Going to Do?, and for her Doppelganger book, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Tim Butler. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Alicia Keys singing Bob Dylan's Pressing On.
Pressing on.
I don't speak as a Democrat or a Republican, nor in America. I speak as a victim of America's so-called democracy. You and I have never seen democracy. All we've seen is hypocrisy. We don't see any American dream. We've experienced only the American nightmare. And the generation that's coming up now can see it and are not afraid to say it. If you go to jail, so what? If you're black, you were born in jail. In the North as well as the South. Stop talking about the South. As long as you're south of the Canadian border, you're South.
That's Malcolm X, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X and the politics of race. Malcolm X's life represents an extraordinary evolution and transformation from street hustler and ex-con to an intellectual visionary with a race and class analysis. He went from being a narrow nationalist to incorporating a broad global perspective. He articulated a strong challenge to the system of power and privilege. Consequently, the FBI wiretapped Malcolm, read his mail, and kept him under surveillance. A riveting orator, he gave talks throughout the country, including his famous ballot or the bullet speech. On February 21, 1965, Malcolm X was gunned down at the Audubon Ballroom in West Harlem. To talk about Malcolm's life and work and his continuing relevance for today is Michael Eric Dyson. Michael Eric Dyson, a globally renowned scholar of race, religion, and contemporary culture, is the Centennial Chair and University Distinguished Professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of many books, including Entertaining Race and Represent, The Unfinished Fight for the Vote. This classic from the AR archives marks Malcolm X's centenary. It was recorded at the University of Colorado as part of Black History Month in 1995. And now, Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X.
Malcolm X remains a haunting figure in the collective imagination of many people of color, but he also haunts the American landscape in broad terms. He does so because he is the supreme embodiment of the ostensible politics of black rage. That is, Malcolm X is the point man in the furious onslaught of black rage directed at the premises and practices of white supremacy. A person who garnered such tremendous acclaim because of his rhetorical scorn heaped upon the heads of those he believed were the detrimental embodiment of ideals that harmed African American people and of a vicious history of racism that undermined African American life. But Malcolm X was much more than a point man in this vicious onslaught and this vigorous onslaught of black rage directed at white supremacy. Now, we should admit that he certainly knew how to manipulate the rhetoric of rage, and not simply at white Americans. Malcolm X was known to, as we all know, police the boundaries of black identity by claiming a privileged spot within the framework of both African American leadership, but more important, within the framework of identification with average, everyday, ordinary black Americans. Malcolm's appeal was not simply that he forced white people to deal with black people on their own terms, that is, on black Americans' own terms, not the kind of kowtowing and yes-siring and yes-ma'aming and manipulation of the rhetoric of Christian love, even though it masked a universe and a cosmos of passion to resist the function of white racism, that is, to slip through the premises of white superiority, the ingenious manner in which Martin Luther King Jr. and others in the civil rights movement appealed to the conscience of white Americans, and by appealing to the conscience of white Americans to enact a drama of resistance to racial domination. Malcolm X wanted to do it on the terms that were indigenous to the mindset of everyday people. And that is that he spoke in such powerful and lucid ways, with such eloquent oration and declamation. The deepest held, most cherished principles of fierce pride, that could scarcely be granted public perception or at least public airing. And yet Malcolm did that. He spoke truth to power in ways that made people uncomfortable, white and black. He was about not only calling a spade, but he was also about going further than merely calling a spade, but to describe the spadeness of the spade. And Malcolm was good for that. In very narrow and bigoted ways sometimes, he appealed to this rhetoric of rage to police these borders of authentic black identity by calling people like King Reverend Dr. Chicken Wing, Uncle Tom, and referring to other black leaders as people who were selling out the interests of the African American community. And so, contrary to the civil rights movement and the appeal to white conscience and the beneficence of white Americans to somehow find within their collective resources the ethical energy to remove themselves from the most heinous manifestations of racial domination, Malcolm X was of I don't give a damn school. And part of his continuing appeal to so many is the way in which he continues to be frozen in his own rhetorical rage. In Malcolm's own word, they won't let me turn the corner. And the corner he wanted to turn was toward a much broader appreciation of the factors and forces that made African Americans who and what they are, and that would enable them to move beyond narrow, insular, parochial, bigoted preoccupations to a more Catholic understanding of American society. The irony, of course, is that Malcolm was much more American than he was willing to give on to. A person who was obsessed with purity at a certain level can't help but be a certain kind of American. An American, of course, influenced by certain European discourses about purity. The irony, of course, as many intellectual historians tell us, is that even as black Americans look back to America in some kind of inferiority, America looks back to Europe in a similar sense of inferiority. And so the back-looking lends us a kind of genealogy where we understand the quest for purity is a particularly American-European construction that we somehow see manifested in Malcolm's own rhetoric. And so his policing of these boundaries and borders of African American identity gave way near the end of his life to a much broader embrace of people across the chasm of race. And had we lived, we can only hope of class and sexual preference and gender. But the Malcolm that was more about the broad humanity was the Malcolm who was obscured, marginalized within the history of black American politics because his use within popular culture is of a figure who gives authority to young, especially African American men and women, caught in niches of political powerlessness within the urban post-industrial city. Post-industrial cities which capture the lives of so many young people of color. Malcolm's lifestyle resonates with the choices and chances that young people of color have in many of these post-industrial urban slots. The decreased ability to get a, shall we say, high-waged, low-skilled job. The decreased ability to operate within an American economy that is increasingly captive to technological forces and the so-called super information highway that has few exits in the black community. The so-called ability to participate in American democracy that is increasingly available to average, ordinary Americans and especially people of color. And so Malcolm's rhetoric appeals, understandably, to young people looking for bold, defiant gestures, rhetoric that will speak the kind of hidden masked rage at some points and the quite explicit rage that they feel toward a system that fundamentally refuses to accept, understand, or concede their humanity.
And the debate about humanity connected to people of color, African peoples in America, is, as many intellectual historians have reminded us, a relatively new invention in modern Western society. The notion that people of color could engage in abstract rationality, could somehow make connections between concepts that were not immediately or available or concrete, is a relatively new development in the evolution of thinking about people of color. And Malcolm connected viscerally to that realization. In other words, he understood quite clearly that what was at stake was not rhetoric, but reality. What was at stake was the very conception of people and human beings. And so what he did was make it so clear that it was virtually unbearable, not simply by white Americans who were taken aback. This was not "We Shall Overcome." This was not "Sing Along with the Bouncing Beat of Harmony and Brotherhood." This was rather in-your-face refusal to concede any ground to the morality of American public discourse about race. It was an unwillingness to even acknowledge that there was a fundamental logic that undergird American public discourse about race, and if it was a logic, it was a viciously circular one. And Malcolm pressed that claim in public in ways now that young black people looking for very explicit articulations of rage and anger, and also very particular defiances expressed toward the dominant powers that be. The problem, of course, is the changed racial landscape we have inherited as Americans. As the increase of black middle class, as the upward social mobility has differentiated the classes in African American society, so that under segregation, when school teachers in the middle class were forced to live with people who were so-called working class and even the permanently poor, the so-called ghetto poor, there was a kind of common experience forged as a result of the rigid rule of segregation in northern industrial cities as well as the rural South. So that you could be in Harlem and, you know, you could be a poor boy, but at least you could see Paul Robeson coming down the street. "No more auction block for me." "How you doing, Mr. Robeson?" "Go up the street and Langston Hughes might be writing, 'I've known rivers, deep, deep rivers,' right? You go up the street and so on, this mythical, you know, it is romantic and utopic at a certain level. Not to suggest that class divisions weren't riven throughout those African-American communities tightly contained, rigidly turfed by segregation and the forces of an American culture that refused to allow the expansion of black life beyond certain geographical limitations. But the geography of imagination expanded, as well as the opportunities of people of color to move beyond these rigidly segregated enclaves. And so what happens with this upward social mobility is the class differentiation within African American culture. And so the difficulty of merely appealing to rage that is more than radical chic, rage that refuses to address its own class contradictions, race language that refuses to acknowledge that all black folk are not the same, so that the disproportionate influence of certain segments of African American middle class within the context of black politics and the larger context of African American society means that we've got to back up and then use Malcolm's most broadly humanitarian legacy to try to force a rethinking of the politics of race in American society. And I want to suggest a few ways in which that can occur. First of all, the rethinking of class differentiation within African American culture was a force that Malcolm intuited in his latter day career and grabbed onto in a vigorous way as he improvised in the last 50 weeks of his life. Here was a person then who understood that the battle was much more international than we had been led to believe. That as he visits the Congo, as he goes through the Gold Coast, as he goes throughout Africa and Mecca, as he goes throughout the world, he begins to understand that socialist politics may be a way of gaining more participation of people over in the governments that regulate their lives and more control over the institutions which govern their lives. Which meant that Malcolm began to understand the necessity for a fierce engagement with class politics. and to address the enormous class inequalities and inequities that were rife in American culture and that increasingly were characterized in African American life. This, by the way, is the same insight to which King was granted access in the latter part of his career. We remember King now for I Have a Dream, Pepsi-Cola commercials, McDonald's. Talk about him, that great dreamer, that wonderful man, pictures the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain in Tennessee. And that's all good. But the reality is that the echo that came back to King from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado was the reality of Watts' fires on the ground. And so this forced him, this coerced him into a much more radical disposition in vis-a-vis American politics. It forced King to see the necessity for a revolution of values. Similarly then, with Malcolm X, he began to perceive the necessity for engaging in class warfare. And that class warfare had already been anticipated to certain degrees in his own Nation of Islam experiences, where he harped upon the narrownesses and bigotries and blindnesses of the petty bourgeois Negro leaders who were pimping, in his own words, and prostituting, in his own words, the average everyday African American. And so Malcolm began to see the necessity for what I will term, in a kind of, you know, backshadowing, as Gary Morrison calls it, radical democracy. That is, the need for people to have some say over the institutions which run their lives. And this Malcolm, then, is not the one who is easily appropriated by popular culture, even though I think the ingenuity of Spike Lee's presentation of Malcolm X is that it at least showed us an intellectual Malcolm X, a black man manipulating rhetoric in American culture in the cinematic expression for 4 and 5 minutes at a time. The focus was on his verbal rhetorical skills, his oratorical declamation, his ability to engage in forensic debate with the most fierce of enemies and yet to come out on top. This was an enormous achievement in an anti-intellectual environment, but also it implicitly put forth the proposition that people of color had ideas, even those who were on the so-called fanatic fringe. But even that film failed to grasp the profound complexities of Malcolm's latter-day international vision. Even that film failed to address the enormous transformations being wrought in Malcolm X near the end of his life, when he began to look beyond the pale of race and beyond the mere confinements of ethnic specificity, to look to see that class was a powerful force and that economic misery was spread throughout African-American communities. If racism is destroyed, African-American people are still poor. Now, Malcolm was not willing to give up on the particular formation of race in terms of personal identity or in terms of its impact upon most people who were poor. In other words, even when he came back from Mecca, he said, hold up, that was in Mecca. That was in Arabia. You know, that was my Arab brothers and sisters who could be white and light and still my brothers and sisters. But up here in America, closer to home, he understood that the particularity of race, that he refused to dehistoricize race. He refused to be apolitical about the social meanings of race. He refused to give in to the belief that you could somehow subsume race under this larger category of class. So he had his kind of burgeoning socialist politics in place, but he refused to do what certain vulgar or orthodox Marxist appropriations of race have done, is to re-describe racial misery in terms of larger economic forces. Malcolm wanted to see both of them being given attention to and paid serious intellectual attention to. So on the one hand, he understood that race was still ruling in American society and that class inequalities were somehow linked to racial desperation. But economic misery for Malcolm X was somehow such an important quality of determining the legitimacy of social theory that he wanted to move beyond mere race. This Malcolm we know nothing about. This Malcolm we hear nothing about. This is not the Malcolm, of course, appropriated by hip-hop culture. And the contradictions, as we know, in hip-hop culture between appropriating Malcolm X and his politics of rage and a person like Minister Louis Farrakhan. Now, of course, the contradictions between Minister Farrakhan and Minister Malcolm X are now writ large upon the canvas of American recent American history. We see this expressed, of course, in the Kabila Shabazz debacle that has come tumbling forward from the lunatic mind of both the FBI and the conspiracy predilections, or at least the kind of conspiracy theory that is being propagated within the Nation of Islam. And the interesting thing is, of course, as I've tried to argue before, is that black folk are caught in the middle. People say, on the one hand, you know, of course the government can do stuff like this. People say, isn't it rather odd that the government would cook up these plans to try to get at Minister Louis Farrakhan by hatching up a scheme to say he was being hunted by Kabila Shabazz? Well, no, not really, given the history of the FBI, yeah, which often meant for brothers in prison, meant for us. I could see the FBI stood for brothers to be in prison, right? And to infiltrate the movement of African-American men and women to undermine that African-American leadership. Why should we be so amazed that the FBI could do this? On the other hand, pimping the language of conspiracy covered the contradictions of many African-American groups that refused to concede that black folk could disagree and still live together. And this is the problem, of course, by the appropriations in popular culture of the politics of Malcolm's rage and his rhetoric without digging deeper, without excavating, without going beneath the rhetoric, without getting a kind of subcutaneous, beneath the skin of the rhetoric. Excuse those nasty kind of metaphors. But to dig deeper and to get deeper into the ground of Malcolm's own profound reflections upon the necessity for solidarity beyond disagreement. And so the problem in this so-called age of appropriation of race and popular culture is that it doesn't address the class contradictions or the kind of internal group infighting that disallows disagreement. I cannot tell you how many times I've received letters from people. I've written about Leonard Jeffries and other so-called controversial figures and ideas, and they write me letters, call me out my name. Don't call me the name my mama gave me. And then, you know, I get on radio program, they be said, this is the handkerchief head Negro. Uncle Tom, this is the kind of Negro white folk love. So they invite to their universities. Well, I guess that is true. But the point is, said he's the kind of guy can be manipulated by them. And then, you know, of course, I get on the radio, and if I'm in a good mood, I try to, you know, be in my Christian self, and I look above it. If I'm in my Detroit Negro style, I'm throwing the dozens right with them. I be talking about their mamas and daddies, and, you know, and of course, in style, I don't do it explicitly. I try to mask it, but I try to signify on them, you know? But the tragedy is, and of course, and then I'm caught. Because then I get calls from hate monitors, and they call me up, Professor Dyson, we heard the way you were mistreated last night on such and such a radio program. Do you want to file a complaint? Well, I said, I don't want folk talking about me like that. But at the same time, I can't lose sight of the fact that the forces of anti-democratic thinking in American culture are much more profound than these small groups that are going to call me out of my name. I think it's wrong for them to call me out of my name. But I can't allow that to obscure the larger forces at work. The problem, of course, becomes the way in which this intolerance is rearticulated, is reassigned virtue within black groups that want to, in one sense, police the ability of its members to think. This is not simple so-called mere political correctness. I'm talking about something much more profound than that. I'm talking about the way in which people of color, as well as other Americans, but if we're talking about people of color, have to come to a point where we're able to see and say that we have interests beyond the mere reach of race. That we may have more in common as people of color with people like, say, for instance, Barbara Ehrenreich or Stanley Aronowitz or Henry Giroux or Brett Gary than we have in common with Clarence Thomas. That's my vote. That's a personal autobiographical statement. That the mere rubric of race does not capture the complexity of our own conditions as people of color in this post-industrial later part of the 20th century American capital reality. And that means then that we've got to then look beyond the kind of narrow intolerances that rule and regulate the discourse of black organizations. And that means also we've got to deal with the dilemma of class realities on the one hand and inequalities, as well as the persistence of race and its meanings on the other hand. Malcolm saw this necessity near the end of his life. And to move to that ground is to move to a space where we're able to imagine a radically different future, where not only the appropriation by Malcolm's rhetoric in popular culture is recycled in pop culture forms like hip-hop culture or in black cinematic quests for authentic African-American identity, whether Spike Lee or John Singleton, that the agenda will be broadened, that we will begin to come to grips with these powerful internal contradictory forces that refuse to recede when race rhetoric is applied. Now, the importance of that is to understand the way in which popular culture, however, is a front for both resisting and capitulating to the very thing I'm talking about. That is to suggest, when I talk about rap music, a lot of people say, oh my God, you know, Malcolm would have been just outdone by rap music. Can you imagine a conversation between, you know, Malcolm X and Snoop Doggy Dogg? You know, Malcolm would say, you know, you've been bamboozled. You've been hoodwinked. You've been tricked. You've been outdone. But it's more complex than that, because hip-hop culture can be used to really call Malcolm on the very class inequities that he talked about. Because part of Malcolm's pathologization of the urban space was buying implicitly into the very white worldview he had denied. The contradiction that hip-hop culture can be used to point out to the black moral puritanism that Malcolm X promoted, that was class-based at a certain level. I'm not trying to suggest that puritanism is really the preserve of middle class. I know too much about working class people and so-called ghetto poor people in American culture who have some of the most powerful ethics and morality that we can see despite the new gingerization of American political discourse. That these folk are hard-working. I mean, Newt is talking about the virtues that black folk have been talking about for like 200 years. That many Americans have been talking about for two. This ain't nothing new. Talking about helping your neighbor and reaching out, and that ain't nothing new, right? Now, when we talk about, now, compassion is called neo-compassion and kind of scandalously talked about within the grammar of American political discourse, neo-compassionism, right? Everybody's, every you know, boat on its own bottom and tub on its own bottom. And people have to take, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and be responsible. Well, that's Booker T. Washington. Newt Gingrich ain't nothing but a kind of postmodern, chubby-cheeked, white-faced, pale-faced Booker T. Washington. That ain't nothing new, right? I mean, Booker T. was coming with more flavor and color before he went out in 1915. Lisi said, put your pails down where you are. Newt don't want us to have a pail in our hand. If you ain't got a pail, it's your problem.
You're listening to Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X, The Politics of Race. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Virtue is nothing new to people of color. Ethics and morality and their relation is nothing new to African-American culture. The discourse of blame assigned to those poor people, however, is a vicious assertion of an age-old demonization of black poor people, especially black women. The painting of black women as welfare queens jives easily, ironically, with the hip-hop culture demonization of black women as bitches and hoes, which jives easily with the Nation of Islam's desexualization through the covenant of respect of black women's bodies. That's three powerful forces converging there. Not to mention Rousseau's conception of the culture of respect in the way in which it contains within the hierarchy of male gazes, women's bodies. Dang, that's four things coming together. Give me time, I could think about more. The powerful convergence of these forces and factors then, ironically, puts Malcolm X Newt Gingrich and Snoop Doggy Dogg at the same point. That's a dangerous reality that doesn't get talked about very often. Because whether you call a woman a welfare queen on the one hand, whether you pathologize them as the carriers of the most sick, of the worst kind of devil, Malcolm X early rhetoric, reality that we can imagine, or whether you're calling them bitches and hoes, it's the same difference. The reality is that in all three streams are converging at the point of the black female body. And so what we have to contest in Malcolm X are the way in which his own class consciousness is somehow obscured by his willingness to demonize uncritically the black ghetto poor. And the reason I talk about the black ghetto poor, because they get short shrift within the politics of American culture. They are the image boys and girls for all that's wrong in American society. All of us know that most people on welfare are not black. All of us know that most folk on welfare are not black women. All of us know that only 15% of people stay on welfare longer than 2 years and then come back later on. They employ it as an interim strategy until they can make ends meet. I lived on welfare for a while. We know that welfare can help those who need help. We know some people are getting over, but most of those are administrators who are pimping the system, driving Cadillacs and Rolls Royces home at night. They already faring well, but they pimping welfare. We know that, right? We understand that. But we don't see that presented in American political discourse. And even Bill Clinton has fallen prey to this narrow conception of the ability of the public sector and the private sector to join hands in the face of the government's refusal to deal with substantive structural realities connected to welfare. And so Malcolm X, ironically, is a point man for a very conservative black cultural agenda that refuses to have a class analysis precisely at the point when it's needed. Now, what also needs to be done with Malcolm's humane and radical legacy is to force us then into the obvious sphere of gender politics. And what we see with so many operations in African American culture is the refusal to come to grips with gender.